Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful, beautiful Thursday. Today is my first day here at 10 o'clock in the morning on Thursday at the Progressive Radio Network, and you're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green. And I am so glad to be here with you today. There's many things going on. Next week is my I Eat Green farm-to-table cooking class on Thursday. And that starts at 6 o'clock at night and goes till 9, and we'll be harvesting vegetables from the organic garden, as well as cooking up a storm of beautiful fish chowder and smoked trout with a horseradish creme fraichée and many other delicious delicacies from the ocean. So if you want to sign up, you can sign up on my IE Green website, or you can also sign up on my Facebook page. So I hope to see many of you there. I am having some difficulties. Ah, here it is. Sorry, I was having difficulties with my iPad here, getting my email up so that I could share with you some of the activities that are going on in and around the New York City area. So this weekend, September 8th, there is a greenhouse tour out at Marion Gardens, which is in out on the east end of Long Island. And it's an opportunity to see a greenhouse operation in action. It's a 28,000 square foot commercial greenhouse. And that's being sponsored through NOFA New York, so that's a great event. And then on Sunday, September 9th, Slow Food East End is having a North Fork foodie tour, which should really be fun. They're going to take you all around the North Fork. There's many different events going on simultaneously, celebrating all kinds of artisanal food and the farms out on the North Fork. So if you're interested in that, go to the Slow Food East End's website, and you can find out more information about that. This Wednesday, my local chapter of Slow Food Huntington will be hosting a film series out at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, and the film we're showing is called Plan Eat. And for those of you that saw the movie Forks Over Knives, it's a little bit similar to that, just it's a movie talking about the benefits of a plant-based diet, both for our health and for the planet. So that should be really great. And then following that, there will be three speakers. I am one of them. And then Bob DiBenedetto from Healthy Planet will be there, and Chef Okima Wilcox will be there from the Live Island Cafe. And we'll be talking about the benefits of a plant-based diet, both on the environmental impact and on our health. Also there to answer any questions regarding food and recipes. And following that, we'll have a wonderful plant-based reception. So I hope some of you can join us for that. Also, Occupy Wall Street's one-year anniversary is coming up, and so they have many different events planned from September 15th through the 17th down on Wall Street. And you can go to the Occupy Wall Street NYC's website for that to find out more information. But there's many, many different events that one can participate in over those 3 days. So I hope some of you will be there. Farm Aid concert is happening September 22nd out in Hershey Park. So if you want to make a trip out there, that is always a great event. I actually went to the one that was here in Randall's Island, and it was wonderful. John Mellencamp is there, and Willie Nelson, of course, and who else is there? Neil Young, Dave Matthews, Jack Johnson, Peggy Young, and the Survivors. Anyway, lots of great music. So that's the Farm Aid concert every year. Supports our local farmers, so it's a great event. The Brooklyn Local will be happening on September 22nd down at Pier 1 at the Brooklyn Bridge. And City Harvest will have its second annual artisanal marketplace at the Brooklyn Bridge on September 22nd. So if you're around, that should be a good event as well. September 29th is the 9th Annual Long Island Garlic Festival taking place out on the island. And then, of course, I could go on and on and on. There's so many events coming up. Of course, Just Food is having their event coming up in October. And that is October 11th. Let's see, the Just Food one is October 3rd is the Just Food one at the Altman Building in the city. And the New York Coalition of Healthy School Food is having theirs on October 10th. So I hope I will see many of you out at some of these events. But I want to share with you my reaction to Michelle Obama's speech the other night. I usually don't touch on political issues really on the air, although many of you, I'm sure, know what my leanings are. But I have to say Michelle Obama's speech the other night was really, really inspiring for me, and reminded me why I chose to vote for President Obama 4 years ago. And even though I have been pretty discouraged over this last 4 years and felt like a lot of things that were promised didn't happen, stepping back into reality, you know, and trying to understand the climate in Washington and how difficult it is to get anything done, and to understand that the Republican agenda from day one was to oust President Obama from the White House, the environment for him to do his work was really, really hostile, and it's been really hard, and he's tried his best. But if you step back and really look at the issues that are important to so many of us, whether it's equal rights for women, for gays, for kids, you know, all the things that are important to us, and, of course, the environment, President Obama's heart is in the right place. I have to believe that. And I have to believe, given our alternative, we have no choice but to all rally behind this president again and do whatever we can to make sure that he is reelected and that Romney is not. Because the agenda that the Republicans have set up for this country will be good only for that 1%, and I certainly align myself so much more with the 99%. And 99% of us align ourselves with the 99%. We need to spread that word and make people aware of that and do whatever we can to give President Obama another 4 years in office and another chance to do his work. And I'm hoping that in the next 4 years, since he will not have to worry about getting reelected again, he will really be able to honor some of the promises that he made to us 4 years ago, really be able to put the environment first, and really think of the future for our children. And that's what's important to me. And so I hope many of you join me in these feelings and do whatever we can to spread that sentiment with others. I know, you know, there was a long time I was holding back because I just really was disappointed in so many of the promises that didn't come to fruition. And, you know, as we get closer to the election and I see up close what the alternative is, that is really scary. And, you know, Michelle Obama's plea to take a look at her husband for the man he is and his character and how he got to where he is certainly had an impact on me. And so I just wanted to share that with all of you. And now I'd like to let you know that in just a few minutes I'll be introducing today's guest, who is Annie McShiris, who is the Development Director of the Responsible Endowments Coalition. And that's a wonderful organization. I'll tell you more about it in a little bit and let her tell you all about the work she's doing. But before I do that, I want to share with you another recipe. you know, this August and now early September, my focus in recipes has really been to use up my tomatoes and my peppers and my eggplants. I mean, the things coming out of my garden right now are really amazing, and the colors of the tomatoes I have are amazing and beautiful, and just can't eat them fast enough. So this recipe, tofu medallions with fire-roasted heirloom tomatoes and jalapeno peppers, is a wonderful way to make use of the delicious, fresh, beautiful vegetables coming out of the garden now. And as I just said that, I realized I did not put an eggplant in there, but you certainly could add an eggplant to this dish, and it would, you know, make it, you know, extra delicious. So you're going to start with a block of tofu. And whenever I am going to saute tofu, I like to press it, the slices between two little dish towels so that I can get some of the water out. So I take the one cake of extra firm tofu and I slice it into quarter inch thick slices. And you get about 10 slices out of a block. You can also cut them into triangles from those slices. It's a little bit prettier shape. You can either fry it whole and cut it after, or I like to cut it before so that I have the breading on all the sides and so it doesn't look cut. And so take those 10 slices and cut them in half on the diagonal so that you have triangles. Then I make a mixture with ground corn flakes, lime zest, salt, and pepper. And I'm using about a cup of ground corn flakes for this mixture, a zest of one lime, and just salt, you know, some salt and pepper. And I first, if you eat eggs, you can use egg white, which will help the breadcrumbs or the corn flakes stick to the tofu. If not, there's actually enough moisture in the tofu itself that you can really use nothing and it will work too. Or you can use a mixture of one tablespoon of flaxseed with one tablespoon of water, and that gets very glutinous when you mix it up. That gets very glutinous when you mix it up and will work as well. And then you can just dip it into the egg white and then dip it into the corn mixture and cover the tofu completely with the corn flakes. And then you're going to saute that in olive oil until golden brown on all sides. And then you can take the tofu out of the frying pan and lay it out on some paper towel to absorb any extra oil. If you want to minimize the oil, of course, you always have the option of putting down some parchment paper on a cookie sheet, laying these tofu cutlets out onto the parchment paper, put a little olive oil on the parchment paper. You can either spray olive oil or you can just wipe some olive oil there. Lay the tofu cutlets down. Again, you can spray the top of the tofu cutlets with some olive oil and bake it in the oven. You would bake it at about 375 for about 15 minutes until golden brown. You can also turn them over for another 5 minutes so that what was the top becomes the bottom and they get a little bit more golden brown that way as well. And sometimes I do that in the oven just so that I don't have to watch it so carefully, and while it's baking in the oven, I can be sauteing the stuff on top of the stove. So that's a space consideration as well as sometimes a little healthier alternative. But either way, this will be delicious. So then for the sauce, you're going to need 1/3 cup of finely chopped onion, 12 small yellow tomatoes. Now, the tomatoes I'm harvesting out of my garden are about, they're bigger than cherry tomatoes, but they're smaller than most of your red tomatoes. They are about 1.5 inch diameter, I would say, these yellow tomatoes. And I'm using about 12 of them. And then 6 of the normal size heirloom tomatoes, like medium size, not the huge ones. Then 1 teaspoon of cumin, 1/2 cup of corn kernels, 1 finely chopped jalapeno pepper, 1 serrano pepper, and a serrano pepper is much even spicier, so if you don't want it too spicy, you can just put in 2 jalapenos, 1 tablespoon honey, and 1 tablespoon chopped cilantro. I am first going to blacken the fire roast the tomatoes, by putting the tomatoes on a cookie sheet and then putting it under the broiler about 3 to 4 inches away from the flame. And you'll watch, and the skin starts to blacken and become a little bubbly. Pull it out and turn them over so that you try to get all the sides to be underneath the flame and get that blackened skin. And that will give the sauce a little bit of that fire-roasted flavor that I'm looking for. After you've done that, just pull them out and reserve them on the cookie sheet or in a bowl on the side. Meanwhile, you're going to wipe out the skillet that you cook the tofu in and saute the onions in a little bit of olive oil. And just put enough olive oil down to cover the bottom of the pan. Saute the onions for about 5 minutes until they become translucent. Then you can add the jalapeno peppers. And you can also add some colored peppers, like a red pepper and a yellow pepper. It gives a nice color and flavor to the dish. I also added a half a cup of corn kernels for some color and saute that for about another 5 minutes. Then add the tomatoes. I forgot to mention, you do want to cut the tomatoes into like quarters, into big chunks, and add the tomatoes to this along with 1 tablespoon of honey and some salt and pepper to taste. Cook it up for about 5 minutes till the flavors start coming together. Add cilantro and the juice from the lime. And that's it. Taste it for adjustments of any flavor. Then you can arrange the tofu cutlets on a platter and cover it with the sauce. You know, and I cover the sauce, you know, you really want to make it pretty, so you just kind of go down the middle with the sauce and then sprinkle it with some cilantro and parsley for garnish. And it's beautiful. And if you check out this recipe, I will have some photos up on my website by tomorrow, along with the PRN website. They will also have the recipe posted, so you'll be able to find it there. Okay, so now I'd like to introduce to you my guest, Annie McShiris. She's a development director of the Responsible Endowments Coalition, and she's also a member of the Solidarity NYC. And the Responsible Endowments Coalition is an organization that works to build and unify the college and university-based responsible investment movement, challenging universities to invest their money in more socially and environmentally just ways. And it has been active in movements for corporate accountability, economic justice, and environmental sustainability for the past 8 years. In 2007, her vision of the world shifted when she learned of the realities of modern-day slavery through companies including Nike and Puma, while working with Bolivian immigrants at a community-based organization in Argentina. Since then, Annie has been involved in social movements to expose the systemic failures of our financial system. Her passion lies in the creation and promotion of alternative economic models as solutions for communities. Outside her work with Responsible Endowments Coalition, she has served on the editorial team of a collective publication on economic alternatives, grassroots economic organizing, and is a member of the Solidarity NYC Collective, which is an organization committed to building a solidarity and cooperative economy in New York City, which is a really great model and has me very excited about the possibilities of where that can go as well. So I'd really like to invite Annie on now, so let's all welcome her. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Bhavani. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome. I'm glad you were able to join us today.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you. So before we get started, can you tell us a little bit more about the Responsible Endowments Coalition and, you know, what it's all about and what you do there?
Sure. So I'm the development director of the Responsible Endowments Coalition, and you described it pretty well in your introduction. We work to challenge universities to invest their endowments in sustainable ways. And so, you know, we're talking about ways that promote the education of their students. So they still are able to meet their bottom line. But, you know, ways in which to build healthy communities and a healthy environment. And we don't think that universities need to sacrifice their returns on endowments while still being able to build those healthy communities and promote the environment. And we believe that universities have an immense amount of power with their $400 billion in collective endowments to do some real good in the world. And it's their choice whether they want to, you know, promote environmental and social justice with that money, or if they're going to use that money to exacerbate the systems that really don't work in our economic system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, and because, as you said, if you're working collectively with them, it really, you know, like in any cooperative, when you pool money together, you have so much more power and leverage because you're talking about so much more money.
Exactly. Yeah, so we work with students, alumni, and community members of universities across the country. We're a national organization, and we work with them to help them organize campaigns at their universities to change the way their universities are investing
mm-hmm.
their money. When I said $400 billion, that's the amount that universities collectively own across the entire United States. The largest of those endowments is Harvard University with $32 billion. And, you know, you'll see smaller ones at smaller universities. And so we try to work to shift the way that universities think of themselves within the economic system, less in a, you know, and try to promote the sense of, you know, public good and economic accountability. Often universities are run more like corporations when they're actually public benefit institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to really hold them accountable to, you know, to their mission.
And has your organization been successful? Have you made some significant changes that you can share with us?
Sure, yeah. I mean, this is really challenging work. We're up against some pretty major powers.
I would think
but
so.
but we've seen some really great changes. Notably, universities have successfully, a number of universities we've worked with have successfully made community investments, which are, you know, making deposits with their operating accounts into community development financial institutions, which are basically banks that are serving the community where those universities are based. And, you know, just this past semester, University of Chicago made $1 million deposits into four community banks in the Chicago area, which is, you know, putting money into the hands of community members in Chicago so they can have control over that wealth. And, you know, $1 million for University of Chicago is like pocket change compared to their endowment, but it's progress in terms of, you know, helping them work towards, you know, more sustainable and community-oriented investments. So we've seen a lot of success with community investments. We've also seen success in terms of universities changing corporate behavior by voting their proxies and by engaging in shareholder activism.
Mm-hmm. Where are most universities invested now? Especially, I guess, in relation to the environment.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, universities are owners of $400 billion in endowment assets. In terms of where that money is invested, you know, we see it in every profitable corporation. The truth of university finance is that they're invested in almost everything, including the worst of the worst. There's two things I want to touch on with that. One is that there's a huge problem that oftentimes this information, where the money is invested, is really difficult to find. There's a huge lack of transparency. And there's little ability for students and communities to know exactly where their money is going. And so a lot of our work is to try to expose and to bring light to where these investments are. And secondly, like I said, universities are, you know, trying to maximize their profit on their endowment. So they're invested in, you know, alternative financial vehicles and, you know, hedge funds and, you know, the big banks that caused the financial crisis, they're invested to try to make the most profit
mm-hmm.
On their endowment. And so in regards to the environment, you know, universities are all invested in all of the biggest fossil fuel companies, you know, including tar sands, including natural gas, oil, coal, you name it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So if we can change that, we really can have a big impact. I know there's a lot of everyday people that are also concerned about where they can invest their money in conscious ways that are not helping to keep the status quo, you know, it's really hard. I know
exactly.
Myself included, I've really, you know, talked to many people to try to find places that one could invest money that's responsible and that's not, I guess most financial planners, you know, want to help you make the most out of your money, and they don't care what they're investing in. They're just out looking at the bottom line, what's going to make you the most. And I've actually had more than one investment person say, make the money and then give the money where you want to give it, rather than trying to invest it consciously. And it's just such a backwards way of thinking, I think.
Yeah. I mean, there is, something, a good resource that you could use, Bhavani, and you could tell others is there's a whole responsible investment industry, and financial planners that are specifically focused on and have expertise in socially responsible investment and environmentally responsible investment. And I can give you some websites at the end if you're interested. There are people out there that are looking to help folks, make money and be able to save for retirement and things like that, but also keeping the environment and social consequences of those investments in mind. And I don't think the two are mutually exclusive.
Right. Well, I definitely would have you share those websites with people at the end of the show, because I think there's so many people out there in the same boat as me that are looking all the time for places that they can, ways that they can invest in a more responsible way. So you mentioned just briefly the word land grab. What does that mean? What is land grabs? What's going on with that, and how do they impact the environment?
So one big investment that we've seen lately come up and surface in the past year, these new up-and-coming lucrative markets that investors are capitalizing on is called some are calling it land grabs. It's basically foreign land acquisitions. And many are calling these land grabs because the transactions are often made without the consent of the communities involved. And so in a nutshell, basically we're seeing London European-based asset managers and investment banks buy up some of the most fertile land in Africa, including countries, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Mali, Sierra Leone, and Tanzania. They're generally buying that land from those countries' governments, as most land in Africa is held in common, and the farmers working that land do not have a private claim on it. It's actually owned by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And then those investors, which are then buying up that land at a very cheap price, might I add, sometimes 25 cents an acre, are then leasing that land to agribusiness companies for industrial food production, basically for commodity crops, including corn, soybeans, and wheat and other monoculture crops, that they're then often exporting back to industrialized countries for our animal feed, for biofuels, for plastics. And ironically, sometimes that exported food that was grown on land originally in Africa ends up back in Africa as in the form of food aid. And that's really striking, just to think about the fact that, land that was traditionally used to farm, crops that are, sustaining and feeding families in these countries in Africa, that land is now being used to maximize profit for foreign investors, and then sent back, in the form of food aid. And that's just, to me, is sort of an egregious form of taking control of the land and the food away from these communities in Africa, and then, creating a dependency on this system of profit maximization when it comes to land. And so we've seen universities investing in these land acquisitions, and that's really raised a lot of red flags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially the food that they're growing is not the food that the people want to eat. Even if, if they were giving back, some of the foods that were more traditional to the people, it wouldn't be as horrible. But the food that they're growing is not the food that these people need or want to eat. And I know there's been a lot of energy put back around getting local farmers back into farming and farming their traditional foods. And this is, one of the issues that's been happening with the monocrops is the people in Africa, getting the getting the subsidized food that we send over to them as food aid, and it's not the food that they need to eat, and they're, you know, it's affecting their health as well.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. We're talking about commodity crops here. You know, crops that are going to make the biggest profit for these farms, you know, without regard to their nutritional value or, you know, any other considerations. It's profit, purely profit.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you take out those other considerations, yeah, you're going to get food that's lacking in nutrients and value, really.
Right.
All
and
other
of course,
values besides profit.
And of course, when they're doing that kind of farming, they're also depleting the soil and ruining the soil, and then they'll give it back to the people when there's when the soil is like completely depleted and then needs to be replenished. Yeah, I've seen
I mean, this is industrial agriculture. We're talking about, you know, pumping fertilizers in and very water intensive. There's been cases of farmers in some of these countries, losing their water because these new companies that are leasing the land are taking up all the water for, you know, water intensive crops, you know, in places where, you know, usually the crops are less water intensive. Some of these crops are not traditionally grown in these areas that are, you know, pretty arid and desert-like. Additionally, you know, you've actually got some of these companies and investment fund managers negotiating with African governments to change biosafety laws to introduce genetically modified crops, which have been illegal in some of these places. So, there's a lot of manipulation of the food system going on, and it's coming from, you know, a profit-driven stance.
Right.
So many things.
Well, I have so many questions I want to ask you about this, but before we do, I'm going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to hear more about how the universities are, you know, investing in this and, you know, what people can do about it, if anything. I'm sure there's ways that, you know, we can get some more knowledge out there and some help.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be right back. Hello, everyone. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Annie McShiris, the Development Director of the Responsible Endowments Coalition. And she's also a member of the Solidarity NYC. Annie, are you with us?
Yes, hi, Bhavani.
Hi, welcome back.
Thank you.
So we were talking about the community's involvement with land grabs. And you know, my question is, what can the university community do about these destructive environment investments? Is there, you know, are there ways that we can, or that you mobilize the community in the colleges to speak out against this and, you know, boycott certain things? How do you mobilize people?
Yeah. So, I just want to back up a little bit to just sort of describe the way that universities have been involved in these land grabs.
Sure.
Because this was all, as I mentioned before, this was all information that was not made public, that was not transparent. And actually the Oakland Institute, which is an independent think tank and research group based out of Oakland, California, exposed in a report this last summer, June 2011, Harvard, Vanderbilt, and Spelman University's involvement with land grabs, and specifically major investments they were making in these European hedge funds that were financing the acquisition of land in Africa for profit. And so when they released this in the summer of 2011, it was a big shock to a lot of people, and students were coming forward and calling them off the hook from the universities that were exposed and trying to figure out what to do about this, and they were outraged. They saw this as a new form of colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, you know, they came forward and they wanted to do something about what was going on, and they came together at Harvard. I'll talk specifically about what happened there. A number of students contacted the Oakland Institute and to find out more about what was going on. There were a bunch of media hits and articles that were written by students at Harvard expressing their outrage to this, wanting to know more about where their university was invested, wanting to know why it was invested in these land acquisitions that, you know, many were calling land grabs, because it was taking control out of the hands of the community. And basically, because of all of this publicity and because of students that were coming together at Harvard along with community members in the greater Cambridge area, you know, Harvard actually pulled out $500 million from Emergent Asset Management, which was one of these hedge funds that was heavily invested in Ethiopia. And so that was a huge victory, one that Harvard has kept very quiet about. But essentially, you know, that kind of public pressure and media pressure, just in the controversy of these deals, made it so that Harvard, you know, had no choice but to pull out. And
now, is that all the money when they pull out? I mean, $500 million sounds like a huge amount, but is that all of it, or is that just a portion of it?
A portion of Harvard's money or a portion of the investment?
A portion of Harvard's money that's invested in the land grabs. Or is that all the money they had invested in the land grabs?
You know, I couldn't tell you with certainty how much money they have or had invested in land grabs. You know, Harvard's endowment is $32 billion.
Right.
So $500 million is, you know, a sizable amount of that. One 64th. But, you know, they were a cornerstone investor in Emergent Asset Management, and Emergent, after that, you know, had to seriously downsize their operations. And I'm not entirely sure, but they may not actually be invested in Africa anymore because Harvard pulled out. So that's a huge change, and, you know, one that took some pressure and took some media engagement. But, you know, when this was exposed and when students started speaking up about it, Harvard was very quick to, you know, to pull out. And so I think that when students find out about this, when students learn about it, and when they work in coalition with their community to put pressure, you know, working with the media and working with their community members, we're able to see some changes. And also students at Vanderbilt, have been working, you know, pressuring their university to change their investment policies. As far as we know, Vanderbilt is still invested in land grabs. But actually, the administration started talking with students about creating a policy around their investments. So, you know, these kinds of exposés and these kinds of controversies can shed light to the larger problem of lack of transparency of university investments and lead to some real change, you know, at the university level around their financial policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a wonderful feeling when you actually see some change from that kind of exposure and energy around it. And so you just realize that, if we expose more and more things and people start getting upset and people do things. I mean, that's one of the things that I so often try to encourage people out there listening to do, is to take some issue up that they find important. Because there are so many, and it's impossible for us all to do everything. But if everybody takes really to heart one issue, whether it's fracking or tar sands or university investments or whatever it may be, and really help to mobilize people around it, you know, it's the power of the people that are going to make a change. And, you know, the work you're doing is so important. It's really great. Very excited to learn about it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's challenging work, but it's really, you know, rewarding when you see, you know, significant changes, you know, coming out of moving money.
Mm-hmm.
And something I love about this work is that we see that these investments touch on every single issue that's out there, you know, and where profits are driven and where the markets are driven has everything to do with the health of our environment and the health of our communities. And so if we can change the way and change the way we leverage that money and put it to good use, you know, we can really see changes, you know, on every level of society.
Well, that's also it, is to see the connections between everything. I mean, here's universities that are trying to educate people for the future, and meanwhile they're investing in destructive practices that are going to ruin our future, and it just doesn't make sense. If they can be investing in things that are going to be good for the future and good for the environment, it becomes a win-win situation. And then, you know, the young people that we're educating can start seeing the connection between the different things, as opposed to the disconnection that we so often promote in our society.
Yeah, I think you touched on a really good point in terms of the discordance between universities' investments and then the mission statements that they tout and the education they provide for students.
Exactly.
And a lot of the students we work with are you know, making visible and calling this contradiction out, because it's a really important one to acknowledge.
Mm-hmm.
How can you be making money and promoting the systems that are causing environmental destruction that you're then teaching about? And trying to promote social change in your classes and civic engagement.
Right, exactly.
It's really contradictory, and it's really destructive. And so we're trying to raise awareness of this, because, you know, you can't try to do good with one hand while the other hand is ruining,
right,
destroying.
Right, which is what I see so often in the ways of the world, right? It's just, you know, so often. Now, so how does your organization work? Do you have like clubs, you know, responsible endowment clubs on campuses, and you're working with students, or are you, you know, a nonprofit that has one main office and you just try to do it through social media? How do you work?
Yeah, so we, you know, we're a small staff based in New York City, but we work nationally, and we have, basically, yeah, we have member universities across the country, and student groups that we work with across the country that are working on these issues. We currently actively, I say, work with between 45 and 50 campuses, and students can come to us with their campaigns, and we'll work with them one-on-one, and we'll do campus visits, and, you know, we'll try to steer them in the direction of being able to sustain their campaigns on their own without our help. We really see ourselves as a resource and a network for students who are wanting, and other university members who are wanting to tackle these issues, because it's a really challenging issue to tackle, and so there's a lot of education that needs to happen. So we work to try to, you know, make finance something that's accessible and something that people can feel empowered to challenge and take on at their universities.
Mm-hmm. So basically, do they have to find out about you first, or do you actively go to the universities trying to recruit people?
There's a bit of both. They'll find us on our website. They'll find us through other big organizations or social movements or environmental movements they're a part of. And then we also will do a good amount of outreach to try to bring in, you know, a more diverse set of universities that are working with us. We'll go to conferences. We'll speak at workshops. We'll speak on the radio. We have a variety of ways that we do outreach as well.
Yes,
to try to bring in more students.
Yeah, I see this is, you know, potentially being really big. I mean, everybody who's listening, you know somebody who's at college, or one of your kids, or you are listening and you are at a school. I mean, every school should have groups of young people working together with your organization to make transparent the investments that their university is doing, because every university is investing in some way, correct?
Yes, exactly. I don't think there's a single university, except for a free university, some alternative structures of universities that we've seen pop up. But, yeah, pretty much every accredited university out there has an endowment, and that endowment is invested everywhere.
Right, and there's
and
lot more than
mention,
50 universities out there.
Yeah.
So we, you know, there's a lot more universities that you need to reach. And so anybody out there listening, please pass this on. Annie, can you share your website, how they would find you?
Yeah, you can go to www.endowmentethics, that's E-N-D-O-W-M-E-N-T, ethics, E-T-H-I-C-S, .org. And we've got a lot of resources there. We've got ideas for alumni engagement. I wanted to mention that as alumni as well, you have a lot of power, you know, in terms of withholding donations. For instance, if you see that your university isn't making investments that are in line with your values, and you can really make a statement as an alumni to do that. So we also work with alumni on this as well, and there's a lot of ways that alumni can work together with students and other university members to make change.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's endowmentethics.org, and yeah, we would love to work with any and all of you who would be interested in tapping into what's going on at your university.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you're also a member of Solidarity NYC, and I... You know, the little bit that I know about that organization, I'm very intrigued. Can you share with my listeners what that is and what a solidarity economy would look like?
Sure. So a lot of what I'm doing is, you know, in my work in general, both with Responsible Endowments Coalition and Solidarity NYC is, you know, I'm looking at these big systems that are, you know, that are contributing to all the problems we see in our society, and one of the ways that I feel, you know, optimistic at the end of the day is my work to promote the solidarity economy through Solidarity NYC. You know, we've got to confront the big systems, but then what I'm doing with Solidarity NYC and what we're all trying to do is promote and strengthen examples of solidarity economy. And what I mean by solidarity economy is, you know, initiatives that are working to meet our needs together while taking active responsibility for our interrelationships, including those with the earth. So, you know, we're defining solidarity as, you know, taking responsibility and mutual respect for our interrelationships and binding our fates together in shared struggle and livelihood. And we often don't think about solidarity when we think about economics. We think it's either profit-maximizing economics, you know, just to make a buck, or we think about our relationships in a separate sphere, in our relationship with the earth and cultivating the environment, or relationships with each other for social justice. And so really what solidarity economics is saying is, you know, it doesn't have to be either or. We can build economies that are meeting our needs together, that are taking into account social and environmental justice. And so some examples that I just like to highlight, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the examples around land and agriculture, because I've talked about some of the bad stuff with that, with land grabs. But just some examples of, you know, what I would say are solidarity economic initiatives with agriculture is, you know, slow money. That's people investing capital in sustainable agriculture. It's a network of investors that are looking to put their money, to put their finances to do good. By investing in sustainable agriculture. We're also seeing, you know, I wanted to highlight and make visible and strengthen and initiatives of communities that are working to control the land that they farm on and working to protect the land that they farm on against, you know, efforts to buy it up and sell it on the market. And so we, you know, ways that structures that are in place that can allow this to happen are community land trusts, which is basically community ownership of land. That's actually a legal contract when a self-defined community owns the land together. And, you know, it can have time limits on it, and they can own it for periods of time. But when the community actually legally owns the land, investors can't come in and start trying to buy it up because community members have a stake in that land.
Mm-hmm.
Another example is, you know, agricultural conservation easements. So that's, you know, the land is privately held, but they give it up for conservation purposes and say, you know, there's a 100-year period on this where this is land that cannot be developed. And that can be a legal agreement either with the owner or also with the community. And so these are actually legal structures that go to protect land and keep the land in community control. I also want to highlight community supported agriculture. That's community finance of the food that you eat and that the food that's grown on farms. That's taking control back into the hands of the community for, you know, what they're going to eat and the farms that are going to survive. And so these are all just examples of different economic structures besides privately held land by corporations. That allow for, you know, more just and environmentally sustainable economies. And I can give lots more examples of what I mean by the solidarity economy, but essentially what we do in Solidarity NYC is we work to make visible and strengthen these initiatives. So people know that there's alternatives out there, know that, you know, it's not just, we don't have to just fight the system that we oppose. We can create and build systems that we believe in.
Mm-hmm. You were doing something also around healthcare, were you not, with Solidarity NYC? Were you, like, trying to get groups of doctors together that were looking to form their own collective, or I heard something about that.
I'm actually a little bit confused about what you're referring to right now. I don't work with doctors, but there are some healthcare cooperatives. There's the largest worker cooperative in the country, Community Home Care Associates, which is a cooperative. So a business which is actually owned by the folks that work there. Of home care associates, it's called Cooperative Home Care Associates.
Mm-hmm.
It's based in the Bronx, and it's the largest worker-owned cooperative in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the statistics in front of me right now, but it's created hundreds of jobs, and it's home care workers, folks that are caring for their elderly at their homes, coming together and sharing, sharing profits of the business,
mm-hmm.
and dividing it up equally amongst themselves. So that's an alternative healthcare
right.
system that we can look to. And there's also a Third Route, which is a collective based in Flatbush, Brooklyn, that's promoting alternative healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So there's basically solidarity economies that we can see on every level of every sector of the economy, health, the environment, agriculture, services, food, manufacturing, you name it. There's worker-owned cooperatives, there's consumer cooperatives, there's producer cooperatives that are all acting, to meet the needs of the community.
Right.
And are not solely profit maximizing.
Yeah.
And so that's
so exciting. I just love people thinking outside of the box, trying to not be okay with just the status quo and accepting it, this is the way it is because it's always been, but thinking of ways that you can change it so that it works for everyone and so that it's not all just profit-driven, but it's really need community-driven. I don't know if you heard at the beginning, I was talking a little bit about Michelle Obama's speech the other night, and just when she talked about community and a shared vision, I think it's so important that we think as a community and what's good for many people and not just what's good for ourselves. And, I think more people thinking like that will be really great. But anyway, before we end our show, I would like to, let my listeners know other ways they can plug into this work. I know you gave the website endowmentethics.org, and for Solidarity NYC, that's solidaritynyc.org, correct?
Yes. Solidaritynyc.org.
Any other suggestions you have for ways that people can plug into this work if they want to get involved?
Sure, yeah. I mean, like I said, as alumni of universities, you can get involved in that way. I'd also encourage folks to visit the Solidarity NYC website. We have a map of all the solidarity economy initiatives in New York City. And you can find and participate in an economic alternative in your neighborhood or region. Join a credit union, which is a cooperative bank, or join your local food co-op, which is, taking ownership over your food by being an owner in your grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
Buy from your local farmer. There are lots of ways that we can, be empowered as community members to have more control over our economic livelihoods. And that's really the crux of what I'm getting at here is the control and community engagement issue. And then I'd also visit, if you're interested more about the land grabs issue, oaklandinstitute.org. That's Oakland, as in the city, Oakland, institute.org. Yeah, and that's a great resource if you want to learn more about what's going on with land grabs. And then there's a whole industry of responsible investment you know, fund managers and asset managers out there.
Why don't I get those from you, and I'll post them on my website and share them with people. And maybe I'll even put them in my newsletter next week, okay?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, Annie, thank you so much. Everybody out there, we are out of time. So I want to thank you for joining me on this Thursday at 10 o'clock New York City time. And I will be with you each week at this time. And I wish you all the best of the rest of the week. And I'll see you next week. Have a great one.